This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I'm Katie Snyder, and I am the director of the college writing programs and a professor in the English department, and it is my very great pleasure to welcome all of you to Berkeley Writers at Work. This year marks the 10th anniversary of this series, which provides a unique forum for some of UC Berkeley's most distinguished writers to talk to and with members of the campus community about their work. One of the things that makes this forum so unique is its focus on the process of writing itself. This focus allows all of us to learn more about the nuts and bolts, the nitty-gritty, the rhythms of the writing life, rhythms that are at once highly individual and yet shared by all who labor to put words on the page. Our featured writer today, who will be sharing the rhythms of her writing life with us, is Professor Bonnie Wade. She is chair of the Department of Music here at Berkeley and the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Chair in Interdisciplinary Studies. Professor Wade founded the Ethnomusicology Program at Berkeley in the mid-70s, and her chief specialty is ethnomusicology, with an emphasis on the music of India and East Asia. Over the course of her career, in no fewer than 7 books and uncounted other publications, Bonnie Wade has attended to the forms and functions of music in cultures both ancient and modern. Her 1998 book, Imaging Sound, An Ethnomusicological Study of Music, Art, and Culture in Mughal India, uses visual sources such as miniature paintings, combining ethnomusicological and art historical methods with history and lore to present an interdisciplinary study of cultural life on the Indian subcontinent in the 16th and 17th centuries. Professor Wade's most recent book, entitled Music in Japan, Experiencing Music, Expressing Culture, introduces the music of contemporary Japan, including the phenomenon of Japanese rap and the Japanese hip-hop scene. This book explores the ways in which traditional and popular music in Japan interfaces with both Western and Asian cultural spheres. Her research has earned Bonnie Wade accolades from her academic peers, but she also writes with passion and style for a more general audience. She has published 3 textbooks for undergraduates, including her 2004 book, Thinking Musically, Experiencing Music, Expressing Culture, which is part of the Global Music series that she co-edits for Oxford University Press. This series is an innovative introduction to world music that focuses on how people make music meaningful and useful in their lives. We are very grateful to Professor Wade for sharing with us today her thoughts on her writing life. She will tell you what she's reading from. It'll be a surprise to all of us. And then she will be interviewed by our own Melinda Erickson. Melinda is a writer and a singer, and she teaches in the college writing program, where many of her courses are thematically related to her interests in music, travel, and languages. So please join me in welcoming Professor Bonnie Wade.
I'm delighted, and I think the most important word is honored, to be here today. There are so many wonderful writers on this campus, and that I have been invited to participate in this is just wonderful. So thank you very much. Today I'm going to read to you from 2 different books, and they're very different kinds of books, which is why I made the choice. One of them is this book that was mentioned, Imaging Sound. It is a book that has to do with miniature paintings of the Mughal court, that is the 16th and 17th centuries. And the other one is a textbook. So we have a research monograph and a textbook, two very different kinds of writing experiences for me. You have in your program, I hope, and I want to just preface before I read from Imaging Sound, I just want you to note the handout that has several miniature paintings reproduced. Thank you very much, Melinda. Now, one thing, if you just look at them for a moment, there's just a whole lot going on in these paintings. Busy, busy, busy. This was a hallmark of many of the paintings of the 16th and 17th centuries in the Mughal style. And I got to be very good at finding tiny bits of music making in these very, very busy miniature paintings. So you may have a little trouble finding the musicians and the dancers in these paintings, which is why I'm stating this in advance. Okay. I'm going to read from chapter 4 first about the addition of sound to visual image, because I think this is what was happening in these Mughal miniature paintings. There was sound added to the visual painting. To the visual content of illustrations, a musician playing or even holding an instrument added sound. For someone with Akbar, the ruler's oral acumen particularly, seeing would also be hearing in the mind's ear in a manner similar to that in which musically literate singers and instrumentalists see notated music and hear it. Numerous examples of this have already been cited in the book, but I draw your attention, for example, first to plate 12, the first one that you have there, because I want to introduce you to Akbar, who was the patron that I just mentioned. Akbar is sitting on, he's the only one allowed to sit in his presence. That was the custom, so he's the sitting guy. Okay, this is the fabulous ruler, Akbar. Now look at the next one, plate 13. This is an example of hearing sound. In plate 13, the Naubat ensemble, which is that set of drums on the edge and the instruments behind the set of drums, also Turki women musicians. Those are the ones in the very bottom with a veil over their head. And Indian women musicians. If you will see, just in the center, there are women with gauzy-like veils over their head. They are clearly Indian women. These participants in the celebration of the marriage of Mahamanaga's son create the sensation of oral cacophony. Imagine the sounds, the drums and the trumpets, the women singers from two different cultures. Then look at figure 43. In the painting of the fighting entertainment provided by Babur, Akbar's father, grandfather, for visiting ambassadors, the drums, you find them? The cymbals and double reed add musical sounds to those of scuffling or urging of the watchers. How much sound there is in that painting. In figure 54, the sound and motion in the center of the painting of the celebration on the birth of a prince is given primacy in the pictorial content. Without the musical sound in that painting, the sober astrologists quietly consulting at the top of the painting, and the rushing, pushing poor, frantically begging at the bottom of the picture, would create a scene entirely without the feeling of festivity. In figure 66, without the imagined sound from the Bing Carr, the instrumentalist, and the singer in that painting, the pleasure of the central figure would be considerably reduced. The complementary sonority so characteristic of West Asian culture, that is, recitation from a book and musical sound, are emphasized in that as well. There is a man holding a book to the side. Such obvious orality is present also in military scenes. Look at figure 68. Without the pounding of the huge kettle drum, can you find it? Without the pounding of the huge kettle drum, the sight of the bullocks dragging cannons uphill during a siege by Akbar's forces would come across as sheer drudgery. Instead, one can hear a working cadence urging men and animals upward. A pair of very large drums is mounted on the cannon that had to be pushed and dragged up the side of a steep ravine for the siege in February to March 1569 of a Rajput stronghold, the great fortress of Ranthambore. Pounded at full force by the drummer who sits astride the weapon, the sound of the great drums must have thundered back and forth in echoes through the ravine. Designed by Miskin and painted by Paras, the scene is crowded with struggling laborers, mighty bullocks, craggy rocks with trees with exposed roots clinging to them, tops of the tents in the camp below, and cannons already in place being fired above. Providing a natural counterfoil and true to Miskin's love of painting animals, a mountain goat peers out between a tree and the cannons as if undisturbed by it all. Do you find the mountain goat? While at the top of the mountain calmly stand Raja Todar Mal and Qasim Khan, the leaders in charge. Okay. I hope you're convinced that the depiction of musical instruments has added a kind of sound to the pictorial image. Now I want to go on a little bit and read about the main character, Akbar. He ruled from 1565 to 1605. He was a fantastic man, as great as, for example, in Europe, one of the Habsburgs, who greatly expanded the empire, is considered to be. And in the paintings that he commissioned in illustrated manuscripts, there is just so much music making, so much music making. And in addition to generally the point of adding something oral to the paintings, I had to question as a scholar why Akbar would be so interested in including musical content. He was a patron who was involved in the commissioning of the paintings. Every Friday we read, he checked up on the paintings that had been done in the workshop. So why Akbar? So I want to read you just a little bit of my deliberation and the sources that I went to think about this question. Evidence of Akbar's oral acumen is provided by different types of information. Recall, for instance, that Akbar's means of study was to hear books read to him. The Babarnama was a favorite, and he referred to it as, quote-unquote, the memoirs of Babur, the conqueror of the world, which may be called a code to practical wisdom. This was the journal of his grandfather. Significantly, he chose book readers for their pleasant voices. For the daily prayers, before dawn, midday, afternoon, after sunset, and bedtime, he also chose readers for the sound of their voices, among whom was the irascible historian Badauni, whose history of the court was an important source for me. Citing Badauni, "And in this year the emperor, on account of the beauty of my voice, which was comparable with the sweet voice and ravishing tones of a parrot, made me the reader of the prayers on Wednesday evenings and entered me among the seven imams. and the duty of summoning the congregation on that day and night he committed to another, and appointed him to look after me that I should be present at the 5 hours. That Akbar possessed a critical ear is also revealed by a passage in the chronicles of his own court, the Akbarnama. Quote, one of the occurrences was the amazement of the superficial at the knowledge of mysteries possessed by His Majesty. One day he heard in his privy chamber the beating of a drum. Though those who had access there searched for the drummer, they could find no trace of him. It fell from the mouth of pearls, Akbar's mouth. Quote, something tells me that it is the admirable work of Yar Muhammad. When they searched, they found it to be so. And I go on with more reasons. Akbar was called illiterate, has been written about as illiterate in the sources. And scholars have looked into why he never learned to read. It is known that even though he had 5 serious tutors, he never learned to read. But he was dyslexic, they figured out. This great ruler was dyslexic. Okay, now I want to switch gears a little. I hope you have a flavor of what it's like to work with historical sources and musical depiction in art. Thinking musically, I don't know what you think about textbook writing, but it's, I think, a very important thing for professors and scholars to do. This is probably our most important mode of communication in writing, in terms of communicating with huge numbers of people. And this book is a framing book for an entire series of books. 18 have been published thus far, and I have most of them displayed on that table. You can see what they are in the Global Music Series published by Oxford University Press. My task in this book was to frame the entire series and also to explain the very basic elements of music: pitch, time, structure, as they occur in musical systems in many places of the world, including in the places that are written about in the other textbooks. So I just want to read you enough of this that you get a flavor of what I tried to do right from the beginning of the book. Okay. Starting out with this sentence. All over the world, people make music meaningful and useful in their lives. That statement encapsulates much of what ethnomusicologists are interested in and offers a framing perspective for many ways of thinking, both about people and about music. In this chapter, I shall explore each word in that statement with 2 purposes in mind: to suggest new ways you might think about music that you regularly hear, and to begin to expand your musical horizon. First, the word people in the statement. People make music meaningful and useful in their lives. Music makers. Who makes music in our familiar world? Music makers are individuals and groups, adults and children, female and male, amateurs and professionals. They are people who make music only for themselves, such as shower singers, or secretly sing along with the radio types. And they are performers, people who make music purposefully for others. They are people who make music because they are required to, and people who do so simply from desire. Some music makers study seriously, while others are content to make music however they can without special effort. To think about music makers globally, you might ask whether music makers are regarded in any particular way in a particular place. At one end of a spectrum, some societies expect people who make music to be specialists, born into the role or endowed with a special capacity. At the other end of that spectrum, in some societies, it is assumed that the practice of music is a human capacity, and that all people will express themselves musically as a part of normal life. Many questions about musicians embed them in their context. Who makes music with whom? Who learns music from whom? Who is permitted to be a teacher? Who can perform where? Who can perform for whom? Is anyone prohibited from making some particular type of music? And if so, why? Who plays which instrument? And why? Do musicians have high cultural status, that is, their music making highly valued by a group? Do musicians have high social status, that is, a high ranking in the society? Then I turn to listeners. When I speak about people making music meaningful and useful in their lives, I include people who just listen. They are, after all, most of the world's musically involved population. Listeners, like musicians, are consumers of music. They are the audience to which performers cater, patrons who are willing to pay to hear performances and buy recordings. Answers to questions about listeners reveal a great deal about the musical context in which they live. Do they prefer to listen alone, or is listening a social activity? Is it more expensive to listen to one kind of music than another? And if so, what does that mean for the listener? Are certain types of listeners associated with certain types of music? Is a listening audience restricted by gender or religious belief or membership? Does a listening context foster immediate interaction between performer and listener? Those are the questions I raised just about the people who make music meaningful and useful in their lives. And then I go on to discuss each of the other words in a very framing kind of way. Now, among the basic elements of music, there is structure. So I have a chapter devoted to thinking about structure. By structure, I mean the shape of a musical selection, that is, its form. Ethnomusicologists are interested in exploring not only how music is structured, but also why it is structured the way it is. Accordingly, in this chapter, I consider both structure as an element of music and structuring as a process in music making. I'm going to skip to the section of the chapter called Responding to the Context, one of the reasons why music would be structured the way it is. In many instances, musical selections are structured in response to something in the context broadly conceived. The short time available on early recordings, for example, caused musicians to curtail what probably would have been longer selections. Composing for a particular opera diva causes a score to have more arias for one character than another. If a cathedral has balconies on either side from which choirs might sing or instrumentalists might play, a composer might write interactive music to surround the worshipers with affective sound. Below, I sample a few contexts to demonstrate this point further. Audience-performer interaction. This is the context, an expectation for audience-performer interaction. Audience-performer interaction can shape performances by even some relatively large groups, such as the Middle Eastern Ensemble on CD track 25. Every book comes with a CD. Arab audiences react in the moment. This performer audience feedback system ideally involves an upward spiraling process in which everyone gets high. The lovely lively interaction can be heard at several points, even in the short portion of the selection reproduced on CD track 25, right at the beginning, during the rubato section, a little farther on, and beyond. So let's listen for that performer audience interaction that I just pointed out as a reason for structuring. Thank you.
you.
And welcome, everyone, to an afternoon, a conversation about writing. During the first part of this interview, I'll pose some questions to Professor Wade to help us understand her approaches to writing, and then we'll open the conversation to you. Please feel free to ask questions that interest you. So I'd like to begin by inviting you to recall some of your earliest memories of writing experiences. And I also have some questions related to the process of writing and even about choices that you make when it comes to organization or language or punctuation. So first of all, memories. I'm thinking perhaps you could recall something from school days about learning to write. For example, when did you learn to write, or who taught you to write? How eager were you to learn to write?
The earliest writing that I can remember doing had nothing to do with school, unfortunately. Is that permissible?
It is.
I was a very avid music maker myself as a child, and I wrote operettas for children, the music and the text songs. I just had a good time. None of them were ever performed or anything like that, but that was the first creative work I ever did using both words and music. And of course, my writing throughout my life has been a combination of both writing and music.
Mm-hmm. Did early teachers encourage you to do that?
Oh, you know, no.
No.
But I have to say that there was one teacher who was really important for me, not in terms of writing, but in terms of analyzing words and the structure of words. In the fifth grade, I had this tyrant of a teacher who believed in the process of outlining sentences. Did any of you outline sentences in school? Oh, mostly the older generation, right? I think they don't do this anymore. But, you know, there was this, a way you put a sentence up on the board, and there was a way. Here was the subject, then you drew a line, and there was the verb, and there was the object, and anything that was an adjective of the object you put off obliquely. Mm-hmm. And so you produced a structural chart of the structure of the sentence. And this teacher she would go out of the room, and if she came back in and anybody was talking and not doing what she had said we had to do, the punishment was outlining on the board. So she would take out the history textbook or whatever was available, and you had to go and outline these sentences on the board. And I actually loved it. I thought outlining was a really good analytical tool for thinking about words and sentence structure. I'm sorry it's not done in the schools anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, we often hear in public discourse that writing well depends on reading well, and I'm curious about your own view about that connection. Particularly, do you see connections between your own habits as a reader and a writer?
Oh, now I have to think about that one. My own habits as a reader.
What do you like to read?
Historical fiction.
Uh-huh.
And, dare I say it, mystery stories. Not exactly respectable. Analytical writing is really hard to read. And I have to do a lot of it as a musicologist. But it's not fun to either read or write. And when I have to read it, it sensitizes me to the fact that when I need to write that kind of thing, I need to be extremely clear. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of a, if the writer that I'm reading has been clear, then I get it. And it holds my attention. But if it's not clear, I don't, and it doesn't hold my attention. So this clarity point, I think, is a really important point. Particularly in textbook writing, you've really got to be clear about things.
So that analytical reading and writing isn't your first choice for pleasurable reading.
No.
I think some of the students here and others might agree with that.
No.
Mm-hmm. Changing topics just a little bit, would you paint a picture for us of your own writing process?
Where do you like to write? What role does drafting have? Do you revise? When do you write?
I love to write where I can look out a window and see trees and the sky and other things, because when I stop to think about what I'm writing, I want to see something beautiful outside. But, you know, that could be even in the library if you look out the window. It took me a while to develop the writing techniques that I have now. And I would encourage people who are young and learning to write, if it just doesn't come easily to you right now, you know, just keep working at another way of doing it. I do revise. Mm-hmm. I revise a lot. Because I work on deadlines for the most part, mm-hmm. what I do is I start out in the morning with everything that I think, I have a plan in my mind what I'm going to do in that day. And the evening before, I organize the resources I'm going to need so that I don't spend creative writing time organizing things. I've just got them all there. And then I sit down and I try to write. And if it doesn't come, if it doesn't happen, I just write anything that comes into my head. And I don't erase it or delete it. But if it's not right, I just skip down a few lines, you know, hit the return button, and start writing again. And eventually I find that my mind focuses and I can go on with the writing. Then I can delete all that stuff that I started with. And then I try to make myself keep writing new stuff. Keep writing, keep writing, keep writing. Don't go back and revise too much all the time. Just keep it fresh. And then when I'm tired and I can't think about it anymore, then I'll go back and I will look at what I just wrote and I'll revise a bit. Now, the problem with some people, and it used to be for me, is that I just never got anything written fast enough for the deadlines because I was revising all the time. Uh-huh. So this was a habit that I had to work through. So at the end of the day, when I'm just tired and I can't write anymore, and I do write in big chunks. You asked what time of day I like to write. I try to write as long in the day as I possibly can because I don't have many days to do it in, so it's a matter of efficiency. But at the end of the day, I'll close it off, and then the next morning I will only permit myself to go back and look at what I wrote the previous day. Nothing farther back than that if I go back. But I do find that it helps me to focus.
And why do you limit yourself to the
Because I would just revise, 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 and I would never get anything written further than I had written the previous day. Mm-hmm. And that gets you less, you don't get as far in your writing as you need to if you're working on deadlines.
During this revising process, do you turn to readers or editors for reactions during the process?
Not much.
Mm-hmm.
I have good colleagues and friends that I can talk about the writing with. And so if I'm having trouble getting something clear or getting past something, what I'll do is go have a conversation about it. Would you talk with me? Let me talk this through to you. And so I switch to the oral process and away from the writing process. And work it through in my mind, and then I go back to the writing.
Mm-hmm. When Katie Snyder made her introductory remarks, she mentioned that you edited the series of books that are on display there, and we know that you also authored the first book in the series, Thinking Musically. I was interested in something that you wrote in the preface. You describe choices that you had to make for organizing the material, and certainly this is a task that all writers can relate to, organizing the information that we've collected. You say in the preface that ultimately you went against what might be considered the traditional way of presenting, in this case, the basic elements of music. And instead drew on your teaching experiences to help you decide how to organize the material. Would you speak about that decision-making process?
Happy to. Writing a textbook was a wonderful way of connecting my teaching with my writing. in making decisions about what I needed to address, I remembered the questions that the students had asked. What wasn't clear, what was hard to understand. And I realized that there are certain questions that are going to be asked if you don't just answer them right away. So I think the most important thing about conceiving that textbook was that I knew the students weren't going to understand this thing, and so right away I spoke to that thing. Mm-hmm. So that the questions didn't, I tried to anticipate their questions rather than having them arise because I didn't get to it fast enough. And there I could rely on my teaching. Mm-hmm. I knew which questions were going to come up and needed answering. Mm-hmm. Of course, in this book, I'm speaking to a whole lot of musical traditions that I'm not a specialist in. And so I had to rely on my collaborators and the authors of the other volumes. I do hope you'll just take a look at these to see what they are. They were all writing about what they were specialists in, mm-hmm. and I could take from their writing, because we were all doing it at the same time, what they considered to be the important points that were arising. And I told them to use the same technique, you know, go from your teaching to writing a textbook. And so, yes, I did. But there were a couple of principles also that I decided in this. One is that in the field of music studies, most of the textbooks, I would say 99% of the textbook, talk about the Western world, and then they talk about what is not the Western world. Mm-hmm. And within the Western world, particularly on the part of music historians, they really are talking about elite culture. And there's this divide, there's this gulf between types of music. So the students in one textbook are not really getting things put in perspective with each other. And I was determined as an ethnomusicologist, because I was trained in Western music as well. I was trained first as a musicologist and then as an ethnomusicologist. I was determined that I was going to create a level playing field in this book and in the series, and I was going to address Western musical principles at the same level of explanation that I address Arab or Japanese or North Indian or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. So there would be a level playing field, and I would apply the same questions to musics that had been set apart as somehow different. That was a principle. Another big one, which is, of course, less interesting, I suppose, in the big picture, is that the standard procedure for explaining the basic elements of music in textbooks is to start out with melody. First, you talk about pitch, and you talk about melody, and then you get to rhythm and meter. It's always been like this. And then forms and structures. And I decided that I would stick to the standard. We would talk about pitch, we would talk about rhythm, a time, and then we would talk about structure. But I reversed the order. I put organization of time before talking about organization of pitch, because that's where the students are interested. And I really think that you need to take students from where they are and then take them to where you hope they might go. That's a basic principle in my teaching. Mm-hmm. And so I put rhythm first, and it was very interesting. I've been asked to do a second edition of this little book, and I've been working on it, and of only two of the 12 reviewers that the press asked for wanted me to reverse it back to melody. Why didn't she talk about melody first? Uh-huh. But only two. Mm-hmm. So it seems to have worked in the classroom. Yes.
Okay. as I looked through a volume of musical transcriptions that accompany your PhD dissertation, I thought about musical notation as a kind of alphabet. And so many Berkeley writers are multilingual writers, some with native languages having different orthographies. And I wondered if you saw a connection between being able to read music and multilingualism.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Learning to read music is like learning another language. It's a kind of literacy.
In what ways?
If you can read music you can get farther into the structure. You can think about the meanings of things and the structures of things. And it's a system. It's just a system. Musical notation is just a system. And there are hundreds of them around the world, just as there are hundreds and hundreds of languages around the world. So once you learn that, then it's an entry into other things at greater depth.
Your 1983 book, Performing Arts in India. In the introduction to that book, you comment on the work of art historians who assign dates to art based on particular features. You mentioned the hands and faces and the coloring, the architecture, the furniture. You also mentioned musicians and musical instruments. 15 years later, you wrote the book Imaging Sound, which seems to build on such an analysis, as though an insight you had while working on one book led to a new line of inquiry. Would you comment on this, perhaps the notion of writing as a means to discovery?
That's very interesting. I had completely forgotten about that. I'm really surprised I noticed that. Yes, one thing leads to another, although I made radical shifts in my writing and my research. I've had three eras of research in my life. I started out working on a classical music form in North India, highly musicologically, very analytical. It was an improvisatory genre. And we were into genre studies in the 70s and 80s. And but the sources were not historical. They were people. Ethnomusicologists go out and work with people. And what I realized when I finished writing that book, which took me 12 years, like it was all the graduate time, and then you write it up, and then you're supposed to teach for a few years, and finally go back and revise the dissertation, and, you know, so there's about 12 years you're working on one project, in a way, one big project. And when I got to the end of that, I thought, you know, I don't know much about the history of this music, because the sources aren't there. It's an orally transmitted music. There isn't much transcription of the music into notation. And the farthest you could go back really was hints of what the late 19th century music might have been, but basically it was from recordings. So that's more contemporary times.
Yes.
And so having finished that work, I thought, I want to do history. And that led to Imaging Sound.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought, you know, how do you do history when you have an orally transmitted music, when there's no musical notation? Basically what we have is there's a lot of theoretical writing. Theoretical, like what is this melody, what is this raga? A lot of theoretical writing, a lot of writing about ancient times, but truly ancient times, not the time when the genre was developed that I was working with. So what do you do to study the history of Indian music? And about that time, I was going to a lot of art museums. I love to go to art museums. And of course, I was completely drawn to the Mughal period paintings. I love these paintings. Aren't they incredible? The amount of detail in them, and there were just so many of them. And I suddenly thought in a museum one day, you know, there are 20 pictures mounted here, and 17 of them have music depicted in them. This is extraordinary. And I thought, well, maybe these paintings are a source for learning something about the history of music in India. And that's what led me to the book. But it was a great leap. And I spent the next 14 years, I had to study Indian art history. I had to study art history in general and Indian art history, which I didn't know anything about. Because, you know, artists are artists. And whether you can use what they do as documentation of anything is a huge question. So I had to learn critical skills from art history. And I didn't know about Mughal period history. I had studied contemporary Indian history for my first project. So I had to read Mughal period history. And it was a great adventure. And I had a wonderful time. It's my favorite research of all time. But when I finished this, I thought to myself, Bonnie, you really love to work with people, and in this book you haven't been working with people much. It's not an ethnographic project. And I thought, I really want to get back to working with people. And I had always been interested in Japan, actually wrote a master's thesis on Japan in graduate school days from having lived there and studied music there. And I thought, well, I've probably got one more big project with the 14-year kind of commitment ahead of me. So what am I going to do? And I decided that I would retool seriously to be a Japanologist, and I've been trying to do that. Okay. It's like going back to school. I had to do language. I had to do all this stuff. But I'm doing an ethnographic project in Japan. So yes, things are connected.
Katie mentioned something about Japanese rap, and that part of the Music in Japan book also interested me. Do you want to just say something about
rap?
Rap in Japan?
Rap in Japan is really interesting. Mind you, I have not done the research on rap in Japan. I was highly dependent on graduate students to tell me what was going on, but then of course I got into it. Rap is very different. It is youth culture, and it is movement as well as music culture, but the things that they're writing about are not the same subject matter. They are, yes, complaining about the conditions they live in and that kind of thing, but it is not the poor and the deprived youth who are doing the rap, and so the subject of it, and it's not especially a drug culture at all. There hasn't been that association. I mean, my graduate students who would go to rap performances in Japan would say to me, you know, you expect it to just be, you know, everyone high on drugs and all that kinds of things. And no, it's just not that way. Okay. So it is youth culture and it's youth expression. And it's also interesting in terms of text because rhyme, you know, rhyme and steady rhythm and that kind of thing really just go against the grain of the language. So it's an interesting subject.
When Steve Tollefson asked me to provide him with some excerpts from your writing for the program, I knew exactly right away one in particular that I wanted to give to him. And this is the reason. In writing classes, we often draw our students' attention to certain rhetorical patterns as they appear in the text that the students read, so that students can use those patterns in their own writing. And one fundamental pattern in academic prose is the sequence of claim, evidence, and implication. Would you please read what appears as the first quotation inside the program? Would you just read that to us? And while we listen to you, I think we can think about that sequence of claim, evidence, and implication.
In the past three decades, I wrote this.
You did.
In the past three decades, interest in music around the world has surged, as evidenced in the proliferation of courses at the college level, the burgeoning world music market in the recording business, and the extent to which musical performance is evoked as a lure in the international tourist industry. This heightened interest has encouraged an explosion in ethnomusicological research and publication, including the production of reference works and textbooks.
Do you see the pattern? So I wonder, do you think consciously of rhetorical patterns when you write or when you're revising?
No.
No? Okay. Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a kind of a motivation. It's been very exciting being an ethnomusicologist, because it is a relatively new field. Second half of the 20th century really got going. And we didn't have much in the way of teaching materials that you can just assume you're going to have in the more established fields. And so it's been a process of watching ethnomusicology becoming one of the disciplines for which you have the things you expect with the established disciplines, like production of reference works and textbooks. It was a huge, huge, huge thing when in the 1980s the major English language encyclopedia for music, the Garland, Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, they decided that they were going to expand the coverage of things beyond the Western art music sphere. and fully a third of the new edition of the dictionary was devoted to other musics. And with, as they have revised even more since then, the percentage is greater and greater and greater. And then, lo and behold, we got our own reference work, the Garland Encyclopedia. We had never had one before, but you can see how these very basic things that you expect to have in a standard field, ethnomusicologists have just been writing feverishly to produce these new works. It's taken a lot of our energy. And
well,
time.
Speaking writing feverishly, some of your sentences are so long and complex that I noticed that you make very full use of the range of punctuation choices that you have at your disposal. Choices that I think help readers navigate our way through these long sentences. So the second excerpt I chose for the program is one of the longest sentences I came across. Would you mind just reading that? And as we listen, we can look at all those punctuation choices that you made.
Documentation for the section on the cultural milieu is drawn from treatises, both Sanskrit and vernacular, from travel accounts and royal court chronicles, monographs and surveys of history and culture written from the Indian, both Hindu and Muslim, and the Western perspectives, from studies of the Indian religions, newspapers, magazine articles, and music critics' reviews from the 1940s to 1971, and from personal interviews held both in the United States and in India during my residence there in 1965, 1968, and 1969. Goodness, I wonder if I would do that now.
Well, whether you would or wouldn't, I think it's a wonderful sample for us. It's a reminder for us that we do have choices and that we can, you know, help our readers understand our ideas.
Absolutely.
When we make these choices wisely.
Punctuation is just so important because it really shows you connections. The intellectual connections, the extension of ideas when you say hyphen, right, as opposed to ending a unit. You know, this is an extension. Expand your attention to something more and then go back to where you were. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Punctuation is totally important. It got left out of the outlining in the fifth grade exercises, but...
Well, it was brought to your attention at some point.
Yeah, at some point.
Bonnie Wade, you've shared your time and your experience and music with us this afternoon, of offering us new ways to think about music and text and even our own relationships to writing. So on behalf of all of us here today, I'd like to say thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.